Thank you very much. Of course, I'll start by thanking the organizer for having me talk at this meeting with myself. Okay, I'll just begin with an equation, in the Schrodinger equation. Strangely enough, nobody else at this meeting has shown the Schrodinger equation yet, although this is a meeting on quantum mechanics. Anyway, I'll show it to you. And well, here it is, linear Schrodinger equation already in the semi-classical scaling. So you can think of epsilon as a small parameter. We have the initial value problem and assume that the initial datum is given in the so-called WKB form, meaning the phase of this complex function is just large, scaled by 1 over epsilon, to be precise.
Can you turn down the light, please?
Can I turn down the light?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay,
so psi is the complex valued wave function. As I said, epsilon is the semi-classical parameter, which is assumed to be small. And v of x, the function that you see here, is assumed to be a given real valued potential field. I'm going to do nonlinearities later on. Okay, well, there's a linear equation, but keep in mind the classical job of quantum mechanics is, of course, a nonlinear one, to be precise, a quadratically nonlinear one. We have to compute observables, and typically averages of observables are quadratic functionals of the wave function. Well, here you see position density, here you see the current density, and so on. So underlying the linear Schrodinger equation, there is even a nonlinear problem. Okay, just a very simple example, the free Schrodinger equation, we can do all computations explicitly. The potential V is assumed to be zero. Let me assume that at time t equals zero, I prescribe this plane wave initial condition. The wave vector here is supposed to be k divided by epsilon, so meaning order of magnitude of the wave vector is 1 over epsilon. Well, the computation is explicit. Here you see the solution. But what can we see from the explicit form? Well, first of all, you see that space-time order epsilon wavelength oscillations are propagated in space and time. And secondly, what you see is the dispersion relation of minus the Laplacian half enters here. Clearly, when the potential V is not constant zero, you cannot do this explicit computation anymore. You have to think of something else. What people thought of actually a long time ago, and in particular Wenzel's, Kramers, and Bridoin, is the so-called, what we call now the WKB answer. It's basically write the wave function in this form. And let me say that at this point, this is of course not really an answer. This is just a complex representation of the complex valued function psi. Take this representation, plug it into the Schrodinger equation, separate real and imaginary parts. Outcomes were defined in every quantum mechanics book on page 5 to 8. And that is this coupled system consisting of a transport equation and a phase equation. Now, equivalently, you can rewrite this if you define the gradient of the phase S as the velocity V. You can rewrite it in this, if you want, Euler-type form. Well, or to be more precise, what we have here is the so-called quantum hydrodynamic equations, which are basically a dispersively regularized irrotational compressible Euler system. Now, in particular, you have an external pressure, which is given by the gradient of the external potential V, and we have what is called the internal quantum pressure. This is this term, essentially, that appears here on the right-hand side, sometimes also referred to as the Bohm pressure. Well, this is extremely well known, of course, and now we can think of what happens as epsilon tends to zero. Well, formally, well, let me go back. Formally, as epsilon tends to zero, all I need to do is drop these terms here, either in the transport phase equation or in the Euler type equations. So what I get is a coupled system consisting of a transport equation and a Hamilton-Jacobi equation. This is called the WKB system. or equivalently on the Euler level, I get the irrotational compressible Euler system with external pressure. Okay? Now, what is the problem here? Well, this limit is purely formal because, in general, the solution S0 of this Hamilton-Jacobi equation will develop singularities in finite time. And after this, I mean, this limit process is just not true anymore. Well, there's a theorem which goes back to the 50s by Joe Keller, Peter Lax, and probably also others, which basically says, call Tc the caustic onset time of the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, so the time at which the Hamilton-Jacobi equation develops singularities. Then Psi, which is the solution of the Schrödinger equation for epsilon small, is really up to order epsilon approximated by this WKP form on time intervals which are shorter than the caustic onset time. Now the proof of this is entirely trivial. Just take this expression here, plug it into the Schrödinger equation, use the WKP system, cancel all the terms. What remains is an order epsilon squared term. You have to divide by epsilon. So you just use semigroup theory or whatever, and the theorem comes up. Okay, well, of course, the main question that occurs here is what happens beyond caustics. Three approaches that I know of, at least. Well, first of all, Maslow's approach of so-called phase shifts from the 60s, essentially, based on essentially Lagrangian geometry and essentially something that works rather well in one dimension, in one space dimension, where you can classify all the singularities in the Lagrangian geometry. Other than that, this system has certain, well, this approach has certain problems. In particular, it carries a lot of weight. I mean, the three books of Maslow are pretty heavy to hold and to digest. So I would say this is, well, it's an interesting approach. Okay, then after the 90s, people began to work on a completely different approach, which is based on phase-to-phase measures. This is what we call now the semi-classical or the Wigner measure approach. And there is another approach based on multivalued solutions of the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, and I'll get to that later on. Now, what is the semi-classical or the Wigner measure? Well, there's of course many ways to introduce the Wigner measure. Here what I do is, if you want a pretty abstract one, what it says here essentially is that given a sequence of L2 functions on a specific scale epsilon, then the Wigner measure W, which is a phase-space measure, or Wigner or a semi-classical measure, is defined such that along a subsequence, you obtain the correct limit for all the observables by just integrating the Wigner measure against the function which defines the observable. Okay? There's another constructive approach to introduce it, but anyway. Well, the theorem, which is folklore from the 80s, basically says that the semi-classical measure W of the solution of the initial value problem for the Schrödinger equation satisfies this classical Liouville equation here. And as you realize, I've written basically two cases here. I've written the case with singular and the case with plural. Well, of course, this equation is a linear hyperbolic equation, if you want, and there's a unique solution prescribing an initial datum. But you can, of course, have many possible Wigner measures associated to the initial state of the wave function. Okay. So basically means that to each accumulation point, you can associate the solution in this way. Now, what is the connection to WKB asymptotics? It's actually quite simple. Assume that at time t equals zero, the wave function looks like this, just as I prescribed it initially. Then you compute the initial Wigner measure, and what you see is that it's a monokinetic. Okay, sorry, this should be a psi, actually. So it's a monokinetic, and then you can easily convince yourself that the solution of the Liouville equation remains monokinetic as long as S0 is the smooth solution of the Hamilton Jacobian. Afterwards, the situation changes. Now, after the caustic onset, you need multivariate solution theory if you want to carry on this approach. Now, in the nonlinear case, of course, much more interesting than in the linear case, assume that the potential is a given function f of the density. So that means the Schrödinger equation looks like this one. But of course, when you see this equation, the first thing that you think of is the cubically nonlinear Schrödinger equation, so then f would be the identity. But again, we can try the same approach. What happens formally, at least? Well, formally, what we find is the compressible isentropic irrotational Euler limit. The question is, how long is this limit valid? And there's a theorem which was actually first proven by Grenier, but then I think the version had certain, his proof had certain problems. It was fixed by Remy Kahl, and the theorem basically says that, well, if f prime is positive, this is a completely natural assumption, just means that the pressure is an increasing function of the density, assuming that, again, that t is smaller than the maximal existence time of smooth solution of the irrotational isentropic Euler system, then, again, this approximation holds, actually, in some HS space, again, on time intervals which are shorter than the breakdown time for the Euler equation. I want to check the proof of this, and you find that it's really based on the theory of symmetric hyperbolic systems, using energy estimates, yeah? And it's based on a very clever trick by Grenier, which is, well, the main idea is to write a WKB-type ansatz for the wave function, but without insisting that the phase is real. Okay. Yeah, let me skip this part. And let me go immediately to actually the main part of the lecture, which is concerned with semi-classical limits in periodic structure. So what you see here is actually, you can think of it as a crystal lattice. It's basically a periodic structure where in each node of the periodic grid, you have an atom sitting. Yeah? And let me assume that the periodic grid is given by gamma, and gamma is essentially isomorphic to the integers in the correct dimension, and the spacing is delta. Let the spacing be delta here. Now what you see here is a 2D plot, actually, of a periodic potential which could be generated by such a lattice. Okay, if you think of that, since you have atoms in the grid points, they generate a periodic potential within which the electrons then move. And the periodicity, well, is of course again given by this scaling delta, which is just a lattice distance. Okay, well, the assumption that I want to make for the following is that the lattice spacing delta is equal to the semi-classical parameter epsilon. And that is really an assumption. And I have to say that you get completely different results if this assumption does not hold. That's actually an assumption which is quite good for at least certain kinds of semiconductors. Okay. So then the nonlinear Schrödinger equation that I'm interested in is this one. And you see, it just consists of the usual kinetic term. Here I have the effect of the periodic potential entering. Here I have an external slow potential. So here we have some slow-fast coupling, and then I also assume that I have binary interactions of electrons in the crystal lattice structure. And this binary interaction is by chemical kinetics, is just modeled by this cubic term here. And kappa of epsilon is sort of the interaction parameter, and I'll consider various cases of orders of magnitude of kappa. Okay, let me just point out to you one interesting thing. Let me show you convince you why the classical WKB method fails. Now, take the linear case, kappa equals zero. So So we just have slow, fast coupling, okay? No non-linearity in the problem. Well, then the equation is this one, classical WKB means I make these answers, okay? I compute the continuity equation for the density, I compute the Hamilton-Jacobi type equation for the phase, and you see that epsilon now enters in two locations, well, just as before on the right-hand side, and it also enters here in the potential. So of course you could have a simple idea. The simple idea would be drop this term as epsilon tends to zero, keep this term for further consideration. Well, then what happens if you drop the order epsilon squared term is you get this Hamilton-Jacobi equation, which is of course associated to a Hamiltonian, which is gamma periodic. Yeah? Well, now check this Hamilton-Jacobi equation. What you find is that the caustic onset time is generally order epsilon squared. So it means you run into singularities basically immediately. Yeah? And then, well, of course you can say, well, I can do homogenization theory based on viscosity solutions. I can compute an average homogenized Hamiltonian and I get an equation, an effective Hamilton-Jacobi equation. Well, actually, again, this effective Hamiltonian is obtained by solving a stationary Hamilton-Jacobi equation on the lattice cell, something completely typical in homogenization theory. There is actually a lot of references on this. But the big problem is that viscosity solutions are actually based on a notion of dissipativity of entropy, and this means basically that you have a loss of reversibility. But originally, the Schrödinger equation is time reversible. So something went wrong.
So your effective Hamiltonian still depend on x?
No.
Because you wrote it.
Yes, it may depend on x through, oops, this was the wrong direction. Sorry, it may depend on x through the effects.
No, next page.
Of
next page.
Huh?
Next page.
Next page.
You wrote h bar is h of
yes.
C?
Yes,
it still depends.
Yes, through the effect of the external potential. Yeah.
Okay.
So basically what you homogenize is the effects of the periodic lattice. So I mean, the point I want to make here, this is not the right thing. Okay, you have to do something different. And I'll get back to that actually in a moment. Okay, the right thing is what is called the Bloch spectral decomposition. Basically, the Bloch decomposition is based on a very simple idea, namely take state space, which is L2 of whole space, okay? And write it as a direct sum of what is called Bloch spaces, Sm, each of them basically is isomorphic to L2 on a bounded domain. Okay, and in particular, well, this B is then actually called the bounded Brillouin zone, and it's nothing but a particularly chosen fundamental domain of the dual lattice. But you could, of course, write here any fundamental domain of gamma star. It doesn't matter. Okay, B is just a particular. Is a nice one with a lot of symmetries. Now, what is the Bloch decomposition? Well, take a function in L2 of whole space and then decompose it in this form here. You write it as a sum of functions, each of them lives in the corresponding band space, and when you see this kind of recalls Fourier transform, but it's not Fourier transform unless this periodic potential is zero. In particular, in order to compute these, right, in order to compute the individual transforms here, you have to solve this eigenvalue problem for the periodic Hamiltonian. Okay? And this is just the eigenvalue problem associated with quasi-periodic boundary conditions. And through quasi-periodicity, you introduce an additional unknown, so basically this is sort of equivalent of going into phase space. Yeah, you already double dimension here. Now, actually, well, in this eigenvalue problem, you can solve it, and then you get your, for every wave vector k in the Brillouin zone, what you find is a discrete number of Bloch bands, of Bloch eigenvalues, yeah, which then become bands when you let k vary. And here I insist on ordering them in this way. This has a particular meaning. Similarly, you compute the Bloch eigenfunctions, which are just plane waves times periodic functions. Okay, this is the goal. Theorem, essentially. So assume that you solve this eigenvalue problem, then you set up this Bloch decomposition of any given L2 function. Now, here what you see is two...
Sorry.
Psi m of E depends on Y, which is independent.
It's more psi m.
I know the psi. This is psi m of K.
What is the m?
Well, this is essentially, you have to think of this as the corresponding transform which lives in this space. Keep it simple. Think of this as Fourier. Think of E to the I KY. Okay? This one.
Yeah, this is the Fourier coefficient.
This is the Fourier coefficient in the nth band. And it only depends on K. It's like Fourier. Yeah. It's a
okay.
Okay? Okay. Okay, what you see here is the first few Bloch bands for two cases. The case on the left-hand side is the so-called Mathieu equation, which is just the potential is given by the cosine, and what you see here is that you have band gaps. So basically it means that not all energies are assumed. Okay, what you see on the right hand side, you see two things. You see band gaps, and you see the crossover. You see the intersection of both bands. So basically when the multiplicity changes locally, Bloch bands intersect, and what you see here is that in these two Bloch bands, you have a regularity problem at this point. So the maximal regularity that you can actually show for Bloch bands in any dimension is Lipschitz. Okay. Then you can say a bit more about the sets of singularities, but Lipschitz is really the best you can get out. So again, and here you see band gaps. Okay, now how do you complete this Bloch decomposition? Well, actually, very simply, first you change the scale, you go back to the fast scale again, then you decompose any function psi in the sum of psi m's. Each psi m lives in the corresponding band space. But then the nice thing is, take your Schrödinger equation. Okay, now if psi lives in one particular band, in the nth band, say, then this Schrödinger equation transforms to this very simple pseudo-differential equation. And that's really the main point of the story. And of course, this pseudo-differential equation can be solved explicitly by Fourier transform. Okay? Now then, there's the theorem for the linear case when you have no slow-scale potential, and the theorem says that the semi-classical measure W, which is a function of now x, k, and of course parameterized in time t, can be decomposed in this way, where Wm corresponds to the nth band space, and each Wm solves this linear transport equation, of course without external potential. And that's again a theorem from the 90s, I would say. And keep in mind that Wm is gamma star periodic in K.
Is not the same as before? Yes.
Sorry?
Because before you decompose psi as the psi,
and Wm is the semi-classical measure associated with psi.
But above your psi is the
it's the same. I know, the notation, sorry, it's actually... Now I see your point. Okay. Okay. Now this psi m is not the psi m here. This is a psi m wiggle actually. Okay. This is a Fourier coefficient. Okay. Good point. Okay. Now I see your point. Okay. Just to show you that you can apply completely the same theory to different equations. For example, take the Maxwell equations in a periodic medium. That means you have epsilon gamma periodic permittivity, function sigma, and epsilon gamma periodic permeability, and you write the Maxwell equations in this medium. Well, again, you can homogenize in a linear way, so which basically means you compute the weak limits of the fields E and H, and they will solve a homogenized Maxwell system. That's the linear homogenization. The nonlinear is much more interesting if you compute this energy density. Again, as in the Schrödinger, as the observables in the Schrödinger case, it's a quadratic function of the solution. And again, you can, which is of course L1 conserved by the equation, and you can ask the question, what is the limiting measure? And then again, you can go through precisely the same theory which I showed you. You just have to solve a different eigenvalue problem. So the Bloch eigenvalue problem for the Maxwell equation would be this one here. So essentially what you see is, more or less you see a curl curve. So essentially, what is it, Laplace minus d prime. Okay, much more interesting, of course, slow-fast coupling. So that means assume that you have a periodic potential and a slow potential, again external. Then essentially the theorem says if you have an initial datum which concentrates in one Bloch band only, and if you assume that this band is isolated, what do I mean by isolated? What I mean here is that it doesn't touch any other band. So no band intersections here. Yeah, then the semi-classical measure of the solution of the Schrödinger equation satisfies this transport equation. And of course, this is just what we had before, plus the convection with the external potential. Again, you can ask what is the connection to WKB. And what you see is that, well, if the initial datum is a monokinetic, then the solution of this transport equation remains monokinetic as long as S, the phase, is a smooth solution of this Hamilton-Jacobi equation. And this is, and you see this Hamilton-Jacobi equation carries the information from the nth energy band. So it's completely, I mean, at least on this level, it's different from the effective Hamilton-Jacobi equation, which I've shown you before. To be more precise here, you see a numerical comparison between the effective Hamiltonian, actually this is for zero external potential, for the Mathieu equation and the Bloch band. And what you see, well here, you see that H bar is the black solid line and the Bloch bands are the blue dotted lines. They're just folded outside of the Brillouin zone. Okay, and what you see here is that, well, there is agreement for energy values which are larger than 1. Well, what is 1? You ask yourself, what is 1? Well, you see that 1 is just the maximum of the periodic potential. Right? So basically, the periodic potential modifies, changes everything, and in energy regions where the periodic potential is not there anymore, the agreement of the bands, with effective Hamiltonian is pretty good. Okay. Let me show you an application which is actually a model for Bose Einstein condensates in what is called optical lattices. What is a Bose Einstein condensate? Well, a Bose Einstein condensate is an ultra cold elute quantum gas. Ultra cold, well, you have to think of temperatures in the nano Kelvin units. And below the so called critical temperature, I think there is agreement that at least for classical BECs, the so-called Gross-Pitayevsky nonlinear Schrödinger equation holds, which I'm going to show you in a minute. And you have to think of this Gross-Pitayevsky nonlinear Schrödinger equation as an equation for a macroscopic condensate wave function. So really depending only on three spatial coordinates. So this is not n-body quantum mechanics. This is already after thermodynamic limit. Okay, so here you see the Gross-Pitayevsky equation. In particular, you see, well, the usual kinetic term. You see this external potential term here, which corresponds actually to a harmonic laser confinement. So in practical experiments, the Bose-Einstein condensate is confined through a quadratic potential, which is generated by a laser beam, basically. And then you have this optical lattice potential, which is generated by three laser beams. Okay, and you have this interaction term. And let me assume here for the following that the interaction here is, well, the scaling is such that the interaction is weak. So interaction here is order epsilon. Yeah? So I have two-body interaction and I have a weak non-linearity. Then, for this case, we can actually prove something.
Can I ask a quick question? Are we also assuming that essentially the entire ensemble is condensed?
Yes. 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 So there is
no interaction.
Yeah. Because if we had interaction, we would have to couple with the Boltzmann equation, and then things would go out of hand. Okay. Now we can prove a theorem for this, and this has actually been published in a paper by Rev Mikhail, myself, and Christoph Schwaber. The theorem is the following. Assume that the initial wave function is concentrated in the nth Bloch band. Then there is what we would call an augmented WKB expansion for the solution at time t. And the form is the following. You have a shape function, and you multiply an amplitude function. This becomes multiplied by, what is kappa m? Kappa m is the periodic part of the m Bloch eigenfunction. And this has to be evaluated at the fast scale. And then here you should have k, but now k has to be replaced by the gradient of a phase. S, and here you have the usual WKB term, and now I have to tell you what equations these terms satisfy. Well, there is the semi-classical Hamilton-Jacobi equation in the nth band, okay, which is satisfied by S, and there is a transport equation for this amplitude function A, and this transport equation sees the nonlinearity, although I assume that the nonlinearity is weak. Order epsilon, okay? But if you check these terms here, you see that, actually this term is multiplied by I, so this only enters the phase, okay? Similarly, there's another term here, which is again a purely imaginary coefficient, the so-called Berry phase. I should say that Guyot, Drubowitz, and Ralston had a theorem for a problem like this in the linear case, kappa equals zero, but they, if I remember correctly, they missed the Berry phase. Okay? So, anyway, you see that, of course, the absolute value of A squared satisfies a continuity equation. But of course, it's not enough for the description. You need really to know what the evolution of A is like. Okay? And this is given by this term here. Okay, let me say a few words about numerics of lattice BECs, of lattice Schrödinger equation. What is the problem, really? Well, take this Schrödinger equation with a fast-varying periodic potential. Compute the Fourier transform. Well, in Fourier terms, you get this equation here. And what here, of course, you have the Fourier coefficients of the gamma periodic potential V gamma. And then you see this term here. And essentially what this means is that epsilon tends to zero, as epsilon tends to zero, higher and higher Fourier modes influence decisively the low modes. So that means you get a lot of numerical error accumulation. You have to be very careful on what you compute here. Okay, so an idea that we had is what we call now the Bloch time splitting discretization, and this has been published in two or three papers of these authors, Zhonghuang, Xi Jin, myself, Christoph Schwaber. And the idea is actually a very simple one. Take this Schrödinger equation, okay? And here the kinetic part, the lattice part, the external potential, and the interaction term. And I already put parentheses here, and these parentheses should indicate a particular type of splitting. So step number one is a pre-processing step. So it means basically it says that compute the Bloch bands and the Bloch eigenvectors. Okay, and of course this you have to do for each wave vector k. But in any case, this is very simple and cheap in one dimension. It's actually less simple and much more expensive in two and three dimensions. And as you might probably know, there is still no complete good way of computing the band structure of three-dimensional silicon. There is really a problem in that, but the The main application that we are interested in here is Bose-Einstein condensates, and in Bose-Einstein condensates, the periodic potential is typically a sum of three functions, each depending only on one coordinate. Okay, and this basically means it, that you can get by only solving one-dimensional spectral problems combined with a fractional step method. Okay. So then, how does the method proceed? At time t equals zero, decompose your initial datum into the Bloch bands, and you have to get a cutoff, of course. Okay, let me call the cutoff m. I only take into account contributions up to the m Bloch band. Okay, well, this is actually very cheap. This is essentially a modification of FFT. Okay, well, then in the first splitting step, solve this linear equation in each Bloch band. And we know what it does in each Bloch band. It just becomes this this Fourier multiplier equation. Okay, so you can solve it explicitly in the Fourier picture, and then back Fourier, FFT again. Well, then basically update your function, your solution, by just summing up these components in Fourier and back Fourier. Okay, actually you don't back Fourier on this level, you back Fourier on this level. Okay, well then do the second splitting step, and this is explicit, right? Because this equation essentially maintains absolute psi. Okay, so I mean this you can solve explicitly. Of course, as initial datum, you use the solution of the previous splitting step, and then you have your approximation at delta t. And then you go on like this. Now, let me do a few remarks on this. One remark is that, well, of course, you can do a second order strand splitting immediately from this. Mesh size constraint, this is interesting. You can convince yourself that you get by with delta x equal capital order epsilon and delta t equal capital order 1 in the linear case. Yeah? And the computational cost is really comparable to the usual spectral time splitting method. Now you have mass conservation in each Bloch band, because you don't have total mass conservation because you have a cutoff. I mean, you have total mass conservation of what you consider m times t equals 0, but yeah.
No.
There's no stability constraint. There's a convergence constraint.
Okay. So without letting delta t equal to 0, I get convergence.
Yeah, of course, I mean, this has to be seen in terms of epsilon. It means here you just put your error bound.
Okay.
This is in terms of epsilon. But, I mean, the big part of this method is we need a reasonable Bloch spectral information. Okay, and I'll get back to that in a moment. Now, let me show you a few examples. One is an example, well, the first one is an example which corresponds to the mass transfer in band mixings. Again, I consider this problem. I have the interaction parameter or the non-linearity of the order of kappa of epsilon, and I'll have various cases in this. So in the linear case, kappa equals 0, we know that isolated Bloch bands are adiabatically stable up to small errors. Okay, which basically means that if the initial datum is concentrated in the mth band, then in the linear case, and if the mth band is isolated, the error of the solution and the projection to the mth band is order epsilon. And this holds on order 1 time scales. Okay? Now let me show you examples. Well, in the nonlinear case, let me set kappa of epsilon equal to epsilon to the alpha's power. Okay, and let me make this ansatz. The ansatz is that the error should be of the order of epsilon to the gamma. And what I'm interested in is how are alpha and gamma related, numerically at least. Well, first of all, if there is no slow scale potential, here for the case of the Nadir equation, we have m, we choose m equal 1 here, which is the first Bloch band, which is isolated, as I've shown you before. What you see essentially on an alpha-gamma plot is essentially you see that alpha is equal to gamma. So it means the mass transfer rate is of the same order as the nonlinearity. Okay? This is to be expected. Well, if you add a slow scale potential, okay? Now what happens is that as soon as the nonlinearity is large, that means for alpha between 0 and 1, you get again the same mass transfer rate. When the nonlinearity becomes small, then the effect of mass transfer from the linear potential begins to dominate, and what you see is this trailing off, another epsilon mass transfer rate. Okay. Now when the band is non-isolated, that's a very interesting case, here we take m equal 4, the fourth band, which is non-isolated for in this case, what you see is that the essentially, you see a constant mass transfer rate, which is independent of the nonlinearity. Okay, how long do I have? A few minutes. I skip the simulation of the BECs, and let me just say a few words on wave propagation in random media. So essentially, what we're interested here is the Klein-Gordon equation. Well, the 1 over epsilon square is, you should see it multiplied. You should see this equation as being multiplied by epsilon squared, and you see that all the independent variables here are on the fast scale. Now, A gamma and W gamma are supposed to be gamma periodic functions of Y, which is X divided by epsilon, and they should also depend on a mean zero uniformly distributed random variable with variance sigma. Okay, this is the parameter I play with. Now, when you do the Bloch decomposition, what you find is this random Bloch spectral problem here. So basically, you have to solve this problem for every realization of the random variable omega. Now, example one is a stability test. Let me compute numerically the averages of the Bloch bands and the averages of the Bloch eigenvalues. Okay? And then I apply the Bloch spectral splitting algorithm with the average bands and eigenfunctions. And I do this for different values of the variance. Okay? And I want to compare this with the solution U of the Klein-Gordon equation when I set omega to 0. My omega is mean zero random variable. Yeah? And then when you check this numerically, you see that basically the error that you have is of the order, or the relative error that you have is of the order of magnitude of the variance. So it basically tells you that this is a pretty stable algorithm. Yeah? Okay, finally, a few words.
Can I ask a question then? So,
wait, let me go back.
You are not saying.
Well, I'm
saying,
saying that
if that is both things are true if the variance goes to sigma.
Of course. And what I'm saying is that in some cases you might not have a different choice of taking some approximation of the bands. What I'm saying is even in this case, it's still not so bad.
It depends on how large the sigma is. Is there any relevance?
No, but that's just a mechanism. No, the answer is no. Well, okay, what is the relevance? The relevance is if you want to prove a theorem, then it works much better with uniform distribution.
Is there a theorem?
No, not yet.
Okay,
numerical evidence for Anderson localization. What is this? There's the basic result, or the basic idea of Anderson from the year 58, says basically when a medium gets sufficiently disordered, basically meaning that when the variance sigma becomes sufficiently large, then waves experience a transition from a dispersive to a localized state. Okay? And how can you check this numerically? Well, basically, let me compute this energy density. Okay, and compute the total energy by the total energy would be just the integral of small e with respect to x. But let me compute the spread of the, let me introduce a measure for the spread of the wave. which I define as the integral of x squared times the energy density. Okay? And now let me call the average of E2 A of t. And this should measure the average spread of the wave. This is actually the quantity which was used by Fröhlich and Spencer in the year 84 when they proved Anderson's localization definition for Schrödinger type operators. Now, what is the numerical picture that you see? Okay, so we have a 1D test. We choose a Gaussian at time t equals 0. This is the function a gamma. W gamma, which is the coefficient of the order 1 term, is 0 in this test. We fix epsilon at 1 over 64, and we compute for different values of the variance. Okay, so what you see here, I mean, here is sigma 0, 0.51. So, I mean, actually, going from here to here to here, you should see, you sort of see that there is a stronger localization, in particular when time goes on. Here's time t equal 1, here's time t equal 2. I mean, this certainly looks much more localized than this wave here. But you see it very clearly when you compute this measure of the spread of the wave, the function a of t. What you see here is for omega equals 0, you can actually compute, you can convince yourself analytically that a of t grows quadratically in t. And this is what you see here. Okay? Now in the random case, what you see, is that a of t initially grows linearly, which corresponds to a diffusive behavior. This is precisely what you would get for a diffusion equation. But then it trails out, becoming more or less constant. This is really the localization. I'm done, thank you.